Hey everybody, it's Mo. Did you notice I didn't give you a weekly warning last week? That's because a weekly warning was not needed last week. Don't you love it when the internet connection is pristine like it was last week? Yeah, this week it's not as pristine. Listen, it's not that bad. I mean, we've had way worse. But, it should be noted that sometimes, because we record this on Skype, here comes the warning. Sometimes the audio kind of sounds like a bad phone call, but we kind of work around it, and it's not that bad, and you're gonna listen anyway, and you know why. Everybody say it with me. Three, two, one. Because you love us. So sit back and enjoy the show. Hi, everybody. Welcome to episode 19 of Bitter and Fertiles. I'm Mo.
I'm Christy.
And I'm Shelly.
I was away last week because I was sick as a dog, and we were all away the week before because a couple of us were sick as dogs. And what I would really like to do is start this week with a comment that we got on our blog about a week ago. I'm reading out this comment. I admit this got me a little irked, but I basically when we got it was up for moderation. I chose not to publish it so as not to start a discussion on the blog, but rather after discussion between us girls, we decided that we were going to address this on the podcast. So, listeners, I'm going to read this out and then we're going to have a little bit of a discussion because it's time. And then we'll jump into our topic for today. So I hope you bear with us. Okay, so this comment was posted by the aptly named Love to Laugh. And yeah, and here is what she writes. First of all, congrats to all of you on your success and pregnancies. However, I must say this podcast has been seriously disappointing. Your panel of women seems to be composed almost entirely of women who have gotten pregnant but experienced loss. Besides the one who had DOR but managed to conceive twins her first IVF attempt, which, by the way, is not the norm. Now, surprise, surprise, everyone is pregnant. What about the infertiles who have never gotten pregnant and never will? What about the infertiles who don't have the money for one IVF, let alone five? What about the infertiles who use donor eggs or surrogates or adopted? Your podcast lacks such diversity. I'm pretty much done listening because now it's just going to be pregnancy update after pregnancy update. Quite frankly, I'm not even sure what you are all so bitter about. You were all given hope. That's a lot more than other infertiles have been given. Best of luck to you all. Okay, can I just say, first of all, Miss Love to Laugh, I know you're technically stopped listening, but I am actually going to be emailing you and telling you that we are going to address this on the podcast, so you are listening. Get your facts straight first. Sorry. Let's be sympathetic first. I get it. I am
We all get it.
not, yeah, we all get it. We've all been pissed off, and we've all used a person's success as a target of our pissed offness. And, it was only a matter of time until we were going to get a comment like this, especially with the recent good news around here, these parts. Okay, so we get it. Before we do anything else, though, let's kind of tear this comment apart and kind of address a couple of things that have been said here. Because you know what, listeners? I'm sure a couple of you guys like feel this way. I think maybe a couple of you like with my pregnancy announcement, like we lost a couple of you guys. I don't know. But let's just tear apart this argument just for a second. And then we can move on. The first thing, and I think that this is what really got me going, are actually two things. The first is that our quote unquote panel, as she calls it, lacks diversity. And she says that everybody here has gotten pregnant but suffered losses. So we're a podcast about loss more than anything else. And now here's the thing that kind of got to me. Yes, in our cases, we've gotten pregnant and suffered loss. The way she put it was like, that's less painful than not getting pregnant at all.
And, you know, this is actually something that has been going around not only on blogs, but just in general discussions. This whole idea of what is more painful. Is it more painful to never get pregnant, or is it more painful to have gotten pregnant and then to suffer and to suffer loss? And the thing is I've listened to both arguments. I've had women tell me point blank they wish they had never been pregnant mm-hmm. versus having gone through repeated loss.
Yeah.
And I was reading those comments when I had never had a positive pregnancy test and had hit the 2-year mark of the whole trying to conceive thing. The reality is both of them suck. They yeah. suck in different ways,
yeah.
but they suck nonetheless. And to sit down and begin comparing that, I honestly think anybody who is sitting down and trying to one up people, you really need to take a look in your own life.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that's the key thing. There is something so majorly wrong in your life that you need to start making other people feel bad in order to feel like you're actually getting some attention.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the Pain Olympics, and we talked about this before.
Yeah.
And then when you play the Pain Olympics, everybody loses because you just can't compare pain.
Yeah.
Nope. You know, it sucks all around for everybody.
Yep. That's like telling somebody who's going through adoption that they have no way of understanding the pain of miscarriage because they've never lost a child when their adoption falls through.
Yeah.
That's just bullshit.
Yeah.
And on so many levels. And so this is, you know what? You're hurting. I get it. But you know what? Your pain is no less than anybody else's pain. Mm-hmm. Anybody who goes through this experience on some level, you're going to hurt.
Yep. I mean, here's the thing. When I read this comment, the first thing that I felt was a huge stab in the heart because I felt like she was calling my journey less of an infertility journey. Uh-huh. Just because I've been pregnant, you know, now 5 times. Like, if you read Resolve's definition of infertility, I'm right in that wheelhouse. I'm infertile. Just because I happen to you know, have a situation where sperm meets egg, that doesn't mean I have a take-home baby. Mm-hmm. I meet every single definition of infertility out there. And not only did it downplay my own journey, I felt like she was downplaying my losses as if they're not important, as if losing Nadav isn't important. I mean, it was just, I just felt like I was being stabbed in the heart.
Right. Well, there's a few different things that are going on here. One is that, I agree. The attacking happened and it was displaced. I'll be honest, when I read that comment, mm-hmm. I didn't view it as anything to do with us. I just viewed it more as things were exceptionally bad. We gave her an outlet and, in all honesty, a safe outlet. She yeah. felt safe to be able to write because the reality is, and I know this person is listening, you do not feel safe talking to your husband about this. Your family has probably told you that you need to get over this. They told you need to relax, that there's nothing wrong. And if you are religious, more likely than not, somebody has told you this is God's plan and or that somewhere in your life, you've done something to deserve this. And you're probably thinking somewhere along the lines that you deserve this. And you know what? I'm sorry. That sucks.
Yeah. Yeah.
It really, really, truly sucks. And I am so sorry. I do not wish any of that on anybody. But the reality is that turning around and attacking a group of people that are really trying to sit down and address this is not going to make that better for you.
Yeah.
And so what will make it better is that you're going to have to sit down and do something incredibly scary, which is starting to stand up for yourself in some way. And I'm really sorry. It's gonna hurt. If you listen to our episode last week, which I really encourage that you do, you'll listen to a very brave woman talk about how difficult those decisions were, about how she is in a better place. CDG is amazing. She really is. Yeah. But she is in a better place because she had to sit down and do some hard things. And in all honesty, loves to laugh, I think you probably need to make some hard decisions too.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry that you're going to have to make those decisions. I don't wish those on anybody, especially when you're dealing with infertility. Mm-hmm. But sometimes those decisions need to be made because infertility is not the cause of all the pain in your life. It just magnifies it.
Yep, that's true. I feel like you're so right, Christy. I think that this woman has probably not been heard in her life. And she's not being heard. She's not given a voice. And that's probably a huge source of frustration. And you know what? I don't know what her particular situation is, and I'm, you know, I if it's that she can't afford treatments, that she, you know, whatever it is, I'm not going to, you know, presume anything, but I do think that you're right. I think that she's just not being heard. I really
no,
do.
No.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of what hurt for me the most out of this was I just feel like, and Christy touched upon this, I feel like we're making such an honest effort here to bring a wide variety of infertility topics to light. We really do make a serious effort to address all different points of view of infertility. If we haven't gotten to a topic yet, it's only because this is only our 19th episode. We'll get there. Yeah. But there aren't many things like this out there. In fact, I can think of very few. And it comes from an honest point of view and a desire to help. So I don't know. That's what hurt for me.
I totally get that. I mean, I think that here's the thing, and this is the real, you know, when I first came up with this idea to do this podcast, the reason I wanted to do it was to give a voice to something that I felt was sorely missing in this specific genre. And I went to you guys, and at the time, Jessica, who unfortunately can't be with us as often because of scheduling issues, but, you know, I came to you guys because I felt like this was important enough to you, and I felt like we had good chemistry, and I felt like there was a diverse enough situation that we could all do this. And listeners, nobody gets paid to do this, to do what we're doing right now.
Actually, that's not true. Mo, you actually pay people so we can do this. You pay for the support, for maintaining the website. And this is actually money out of our pocket right now.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I'm not, I do. I pay for podcast hosting is not cheap. And that needs to be paid for. And yes, I do pay that out of pocket. And I don't mind doing that. I love this podcast. I love what this podcast has done for me. I love what it has done for other people. And, you know, I'm not trying to, like, toot my own horn here by saying, hey, look at what I'm doing. I think that this podcast has done a lot for me. And you know what? Love to love. I'm really sorry. But if it bothers you so much, make your own freaking podcast. You know, let's see you do it. It's not easy. Trust me, it's not easy. So, I mean, again, listeners, I think, you know, we're not coming across as too defensive, because really, truly, we feel for this woman. We do. But it was hurtful. And, you know, we always joke around saying, you know, we want your hate mail, blah, blah, blah. And we do. We appreciate the conversation. We really do. But there's some things, at least, that we feel, if you're going to attack us, then have it be a founded attack, because we have covered donor egg. We have covered adoption. None of us got pregnant after one IVF treatment. That didn't happen. We cover hugely diverse topics, and we have, if you guys would see the emails that go between us in terms of lists of topics that still need to be addressed, everybody's head would explode. We have a lot we want to address, and we're going to keep on addressing it. Like Shelley said, we're 19 episodes in. We've got plenty of time, hopefully. And right. We'll keep on doing this.
So one of the criticisms was, what about women that can't afford one IVF cycle? Yeah. Guess what? We've got a whole episode coming up on financing fertility treatments. And not only, you know, how do you do it, but what are there out there as far as funding and grants and other things along those lines. That way people can make that decision. Because the reality is a lot of people really don't know how to do it. And for those of us who have been through it, we've had to learn along the way. So we'll talk about that. What about those that, you know, choose not to go through fertility treatments because of religious reasons? We're probably going to talk about that too.
Yeah.
All sorts of other things. I mean, you know, what there's a lot. And even talking about child-free living. And yes, we're working on it. That's a priority episode for us. And we are working our butts off to get into contact with some of the leaders, some of the people that are really great resources as far as child-free living. And really talking about what that is, because I don't think a lot of people truly understand what it is.
Yeah. So listeners, we're working on it. And you know what? If you feel like there's something we haven't covered and you want us to cover, we've gotten emails like that before. We've had people email us saying, hey, you know, you haven't talked about this, or you haven't talked about that. Why didn't you cover it? And we've nine times out of 10, if we've taken your advice, and if we haven't yet, we're planning on doing it. And we appreciate those emails, and we love you guys for it, because we don't know everything, you know, and suggestions are always, always welcome. We've actually had people email us suggesting topics who ended up being guests on our show, you know? Mm-hmm. So at the end of the day, you know, we do our best here, guys. And I know most of you who are listening feel that way. And I think that really the reason I felt like it was important to address this is because, let's just be honest, big changes are afoot here at Bitter and Fertiles. And we are sensitive to that. We really, truly are. Let's just put it out there, Christy.
Oh, me. Yeah. So the thing that's interesting about this comment is it came in before I even tested. I had announced that we had gone through an FET, and that we were waiting. And then that comment came in literally days before I went in for a blood draw. So I had no idea what was going on. So, I mean, that's the other thing. I mean, I understand people are unhappy, but also you need to understand that in states of being really angry, the damage that you can also inflict. And the reality is it doesn't do anything good in the world. We've seen wars created over petty skirmishes between people because somebody's feeling has gotten hurt, and it can go on for years, yeah. And it does no good. So, I mean, on a good note on my end, I do have a positive pregnancy test. My ultrasound is actually going to be Monday, so when this podcast goes up, I will know about what's going on with my body. But I have two miscarriages underneath my belt, and I'm still very spooked. A positive pregnancy test for me doesn't mean a take-home baby. And I've been on this road for 3 years.
And so, the same goes for me. And, you know, this is the situation. You know, there are different types of infertility, and some infertility is repeat loss. And we've got three women on a podcast called Bitter and Fertiles. All three of them are pregnant. But one of them is a high-risk pregnancy who's, you know, pretty much knows she's going to be spending the first at least, what is it, month, Shelley, right, of her child's life in an NICU.
2 to 3 months.
2 to 3 months, there you go.
And I see you. And, I mean, and I see you as its own battle. We will be talking about that, too.
Yeah. And, we've got the five pregnancy lady, me.
Yep.
You know, who God knows what's going to be happening with me. I'm still freaking out. I don't know what the hell's going on. God knows how long I'll be freaking out. And now we've got Christy, you know, the two loss lady. Hopefully not going for number three. So we realize this isn't a perfect situation. But you know what, guys? Here's the thing, right? Infertility is something that gets resolved. Whether it's resolved through adoption, whether it's resolved through pregnancy that leads to a take-home baby, whether it resolves through deciding to live child-free, whatever it is, it eventually gets resolved. So if by some miracle all three of us end up getting resolved as a result of our current knocked up state, then yay us.
But it doesn't mean we get our journey. It doesn't mean that we don't remember this.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing to keep in mind, is that all of us have lived this, and it's important for us to talk about it. So on that note, what we have discussed as a group is no longer doing updates. Yeah. And I think the rationale behind that is we know this is a sensitive topic for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And especially if you've had a bad day, the last thing you want to do is flip on a podcast and listen to somebody talk about where they are in their pregnancy. We have our blogs. We will use those to be able to update people as we go along. That said, if something happens that's big, people will know.
Yeah. So, where if Spaghetti Monster forbid, there's bad news on anybody's end, we're obviously going to talk about it, because bad news is something that we want to address. We're gonna skip the good news for now, or the everything status quo news for now, and just let that, you know, go on. And we hope for ourselves that the status quo continues for a very long time.
Yes.
And that nobody needs to be updated about, you know, shit going wrong. And you know, at the end of the day, we're not going to talk about it because, you know, we're sensitive to this. We know we've been down this road. Every single woman on this podcast has been on this road for 2+ years. I've been on this road for 3 years. Christy, you've been on this road for
three years.
Shelley, you've been on the road for 2.5, right?
Yep.
So we're not new to this. And the fact that we're hopefully on some road to resolution, God, I hope so. Because, oh my God. Then, you know, that doesn't mean that we're not the same people that we were 2 weeks ago. So, that being said, updates are done. You will only be hearing about our specific uteri when there is something relevant. Uteri, I like that. When there's something relevant to be discussed. We hope you stick around with us, because this really isn't, you know, we talked about our personal journeys to share them, but this podcast isn't about our personal journeys.
Nope. And we've got a lot to talk about.
Yeah.
We really
do. So listeners, we hope you don't hate us. We think you don't. We think most of you are good, rational people. And we, you know what? We think Love to Laugh, with her apt nickname, is a good, rational person too. Mm-hmm. We just think she had a bad day.
All right.
So hopefully, listeners, you're not listening to this on a bad day. And if you are listening to this on a bad day, we're sorry, and we know, and this sucks. And hopefully listening to us will make it just a tiny, tiny bit better, because we certainly don't want to make it worse.
No, I absolutely agree with that, because, you know, it's this journey changes people, even people who are in and out of it quickly. It still touches them. It still changes them. Mm-hmm. And it's in all honesty, I'm never, ever going to, I'm not the same person I was prior to starting this. I'm not. And in a lot of ways, it's good. Other ways, it's not so good, but you know, you need to grow from it. And because of the fact that you grow from it, I think some amazing things can happen in life. So, but in the meantime, while you're in the trenches and when you're in the middle of it, I know it hurts. Yeah. So,
and listeners, don't forget, we're still in the trenches. We're just in a different part of the trenches. That's really all mm-hmm. it is for us, at least. It's just a different part. And really, here's what it comes down to. It's like Christy said, we are profoundly changed. We are here because we are profoundly changed, and that's not any different. We, all of us have at one point or another rallied against infertility amnesia. And just by the fact that we're still doing this podcast means that we don't have it, aren't even close to having it. So listeners, don't hate us and wish us luck, please. Cross your fingers for us, because we need it, really.
Mm-hmm. Yep. We all need it. Yeah. Okay. On that note, our topic for this week is, drum roll,
infertility 102. Because we got a lot of great feedback on our infertility 101 episode, and I felt personally that there was a lot of stuff that needed to be covered. And to be honest, I was kind of tired, and I was like, let's just not do a guest this week. Let's just be all about, you know, the journey of the ute. Because people have found that very handy. So, this week we are going to cover a couple things. First of all, we'd never covered, home pregnancy tests and how to deal with those, which okay. is my favorite topic ever, you know.
I know, that's why I'm laughing.
Yes. So we're going to cover that, and we're going to cover, what happens in terms of, going to the doctor for the first time and broaching the I'm infertile subject, mm-hmm. and what kind of blood work you're going to be expected to do and all that fun stuff. And, you know, let's call it the junior varsity of infertility. We're not quite varsity level, but the junior varsity, infertility. So I think we should get started. And I'm sorry, ladies, but can we start with the pee sticks?
Yeah, let's start with the pee sticks.
Take it away.
Yay. Okay. I'm sorry. I love pee sticks. And this is the thing. Okay. The 2 week wait is a myth. That's the God honest truth about it. The 2 week wait is a myth. It can very possibly be an 8 day wait.
Mm-hmm.
I am living proof that it can very possibly be an 8 day wait. And this is what we're going to discuss right now. So if you're a peeing kind of person, I'm going to kind of walk you through how one goes about peeing in an accurate manner. so that, you know, you can use your little control freakery freakouts in a way that's a little sciencey. So this is basically how it works. Okay.
Well, but before we go there, I let's talk about the different kinds, because I had no idea how many different kinds of HTP tests exist out on the market.
Oh, yeah.
Until I started this process. I was amazed that there are different terms for them. People talk about the cheapos, mm-hmm. and then they talk about what you fondly refer to as Rolls-Royces or the platinum ones. And it was like, I was clueless. So can we talk about that first and then about the science?
First of all, let me just start with an anecdote, because this is how bad off I am. I was at the pharmacy yesterday, true story. Sorry, picking up like a lifetime supply of progesterone suppositories, which is always fun. So I was at the pharmacy yesterday, and standing behind me was a woman holding a home pregnancy test. Now, she was, I would give her early 20s. The face she made, it's obviously not a wanted pregnancy if she's indeed pregnant. But I couldn't help but look at the brand she was holding, and I literally had to show restraint, because the only thing I wanted to do was just go into the HPT aisle, grab another brand, give that to her, and tell her, oh, honey, you don't want to buy this. Buy this.
And you should have.
If she didn't look so terrified, I probably would have. But she seemed terrified and embarrassed by a potential oops. So I didn't go there. But my God, was I tempted to do that. Seriously. Because it's just, you know, there's some abysmal brands out there, ladies. And it just, you know, it boggles the mind what people will spend money on. And I just saw her spending money on one that was not sensitive, that was just a bad ass. It was basically an internet cheapie in disguise with like a plastic casing. That's what it was. And I was just, you know, I it wasn't even the cheapest brand. There were better, cheaper brands. I'm sorry, I'm ranting now, because this is how passionate I felt about this woman's choice of pee stick. But anyway, so let's just break it down here, okay? There's basically the quality of pee stick goes by two different standards. One is the level of sensitivity, and mm-hmm. two is whether or not that particular brand has evaporation lines, which is something not many people discuss, but this is a very important thing for pee stick aficionados. I'll discuss evaporation lines in a second. So basically what happens, like with an OPK, an HPT, once you pee on it, you always get a control line, which is the line farthest away from, you know, where you pee. And there's the test line, which can either be there or not. With an HPT, a line is a line. If you see a line, no matter how faint it is, that means you're pregnant, which is why brands with evaporation lines are not good. An evaporation line basically happens about 5 to 10 minutes after you have peed, and that's when the test line doesn't actually become positive, but it becomes visible. And it has happened quite a bit where people have seen that evaporation line, which, you know, happens 10 minutes after you pee, and have freaked out and thought it was a positive test.
Okay, so which brands are these that have that are known to have evap lines?
Okay.
Because I have no clue, and it would be good actually to know.
First of all, everybody, you should all go to peeonastick.com, which is my favorite website ever. Which was made by a completely OCD lady in 2006. And there's an actual comparison graph of pee sticks that talk about this. But
for this is the first time I'm hearing of this website.
Oh, yeah, I know. And I'm looking at it right now, and holy crap.
It is amazing. It is the most
Continue.
I love this website so much. I've spent so many hours upon hours upon hours on this website. Whenever somebody like obsesses over a pee stick on a blog, my first comment is go to peeonastick.com, read it, love it, bookmark it. That's my thing. So the big offenders of the evap line are the clear blue tests. And the internet
clear blue easy. Yeah. Oh, clear blue easy.
Yeah. Or basically a lot of the blue dye tests have this. They're infamous for it. So stay away from any test with blue dye, and that's mostly the clear blue test. And same with the plus minus ones, they're infamous for it. And all of the cheap ones that you'd get on the internet are also infamous for having EVAP lines. But again, go to peonastick.com, get a full list of brands known for evaporation lines. So there's that issue. So now we've talked about the evaporation lines. Let's talk about sensitivity, which is really the other issue. As you guys know, a beta is positive the second it's over 5. And so in order to really get into sensitivity stuff, I just want to talk a little bit, and this is, you know, this might seem obvious, but it's not to everybody, and I can tell you guys, it wasn't to me at first, about the implantation and fertilization process. So basically what happens is, let's say that, you know, you, let's put aside IVF, we'll talk about IVF in a second, but let's talk IUI, or regular plain old at-home baby making love and timed intercourse stuff, okay? So let's say you ovulated and sperm met egg, which is mm-hmm. always good news. So the second sperm meet, from the second that sperm meets egg, you have between 7 to 12 days until that fertilized egg actually makes its way through your fallopian tube and implants in the uterus. So 7 to 12 days, it not only makes the journey, but it also divides enough so that it has the ability to actually implant in your uterine lining. Now, from the second that an egg implants, a fertilized egg implants, your beta is already at a certain level. I think it's like already at a 5 from the second it implants. So I think so, right? Am I correct, Christy? Like it automatically, like a beta's the HCG hormone is created, and so you're automatically a 5 and up the second you implant.
Yeah, so it's interesting on that. And they consider it negative if it's 5 and below, mm-hmm. but it's that range between 5 and 25 where they're skeptical. So if you are, say if you get a 14 and you're 12 days past ovulation, they're usually not considering that a viable pregnancy. You're right. Pregnant, but there's not a lot of hope that you're going to be carrying to term. Now, it's not always true. There are people that you'll read about cases that they get over, but in general, it doesn't go that far. So what they are looking for, it's not even that you're above 5. They want you above 25.
They want you above 25. That's true. But again, and we're talking about test sensitivity, if you're above 5 at 10 days past ovulation and your doubling time is fine, and we'll talk about doubling times in a second, and your doubling time is fine, then I would guess most clinics wouldn't be worried until, you know, a certain point, because it could just be, if you're 10 days past ovulation, it could just be that you had a slow implanter.
Right. That's
which happens.
So as far as sensitivity, because that's kind of what you're talking about along the lines. So this website you're bringing up, it's amazing. I'm looking at this. They actually talk about official sensitivity mm-hmm. and the list numbers like 20, 25, 100, 50, right. so forth along those lines. That's the level of the HCG when the test is actually able to start detecting it.
Correct.
So that's something right. to keep in mind. There is, now, as Mo's bringing up, there's some tests that are substantially more sensitive, like 12.5. Oh my God.
Yeah.
But
and,
others
and
are
that's
not.
Advertised. There are some tests. I mean, most tests will advertise that they're 25. Most tests won't actually advertise being less than 25, but mm-hmm. some tests will go as low as 10.
Right. So usually when they're saying 25, what they're telling you is that they can detect up to 6 days prior to a missed period.
Yeah.
Which is what Mo's getting at.
Yeah. So basically they can detect it a day after implantation. Okay. Like what happens is the fertilized egg burrows into your uterus and it implants and it starts creating HCG. And if the first sign of a healthy pregnancy is that the amount of HCG in your system doubles every 48 hours. That's what they're looking for. And usually, let's be honest, healthy pregnancy, usually it's less than 48 hours for a doubling. A good doubling usually happens for most people. And again, this isn't, you know, complete, you know, this isn't an exact science, but for most people, their doubling time on a healthy pregnancy is between 30 to 40 hours. So basically you can have an early pregnancy test detect your pregnancy as early as 7 or 8 days past ovulation. if you had an early implanter, like if it really took 7 days for the fertilized egg to implant, then theoretically on day eight, a sensitive pregnancy home pregnancy test will pick it up, but it will pick it up with your first morning urine. Let's talk about that. So HCG, the way it metabolizes in your blood, is that the more concentrated your urine is, the more the home pregnancy test will actually be able to pick it up. So most of these tests will recommend that you use first morning urine, as in the first pee when you wake up, to test. Now, I'll be honest with you, it's a bit of a fallacy. When you've got, I mean, I always do it, but I've had it happen before that I couldn't get my hands on a pregnancy test, high sensitivity pregnancy test in the morning, and then I had it in the afternoon and it was positive. Actually, you know what? Let's just be anecdotal about this. This is what happened to me this time. I did not have a high sensitivity pregnancy test on the morning of 8 DPO, 8 days past ovulation. However, I did have a high sensitivity pregnancy test on the afternoon of 8 days past ovulation. And I basically held my pee in for an hour, and I peed on the stick, and the stick came out positive. So this means I implanted on day seven, and I had a positive pregnancy test on the afternoon of day eight. And this happens. So basically what they want is for your pee to be concentrated. So it's kind of better off if you do it in the morning, but you can do it in the afternoon if you hold your pee in for a little bit, just to get it nice and, you know, concentrated. So basically that's, you know, that I am living proof that you can get a positive pee stick on the afternoon, 8 days past ovulation. Now for IVF people, it works a little differently, because you want to look at from the transfer date. And the way you count it, basically the day that you had your retrieval and fertilization would be what your ovulation day is in terms of the time. Because again, the fertilized egg, it's not only the time it takes to get from your tube to your uterus. It has to be a certain amount of cells in order to latch on to your uterine wall. So if you had, say, a 5-day transfer, theoretically, you could get a positive pregnancy test as early as 3 days past that 5-day transfer. Theoretically. Correct me if I'm wrong, ladies. I'm right, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Theoretically, yes.
Yes. So theoretically, basically, yeah. the fertilized embryo that was implanted in your ute would be big enough to latch on 2 days after your 5-day transfer. And you could, with a high sensitivity pregnancy test, get a positive test.
So here's the thing, though, and this is the thing to keep in mind with, especially for women who are doing fresh cycles. There's the trigger shot. Right. So if you have, and some people use HCG as a trigger, meaning it is very possible and very likely that you will get a positive pregnancy test prior to even transferring in an embryo because you have so much HCG in your system. So for people that really, I laugh because I did not do this, but keep in mind, I am not a pee stick aficionado and I do not like tracking at all. But for people who do like to track and like to know, what you need to do, especially for a fresh cycle, is you need to literally pee out the HCG. So you need to pee down to the point that it's a negative before right. You can trust any test coming out at that point in time.
Very true. Very true. If you've had an HCG trigger, use the internet cheapies, which are the ones that you can buy 10 for a dollar online, to just pee it out. What you do is you pee once a day, every day until you get a negative test. And then, you know, the HCG is out of your system so that any subsequent pregnancy test would be, a reliable result, which I have to say, I'm a big fan of the women who pee out the trigger. I just always find it amusing. But here's the thing, though, and this is the other thing, and this is a big, big pet peeve of mine. The thing I'm not a fan of, and the thing I have a huge issue with, and I'll explain in a second, are the people who try to see if their beta is doubled based on the darkness of their test line.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I see this happen to women all the time, where they get a positive pee stick and then the next day they pee on another one and start obsessing about whether that line is darker and if it's dark enough and if their beta is doubling properly, all before they get the blood draw. And they start freaking out if the line isn't dark enough and all the stuff. And this always, always is an issue. Because it's just not exact. The fact is that these pee sticks are made and packaged in a factory. And yes, their sensitivity is basically across the board the same, but it's different, you know, it's a different day. The paper gets made a little differently. And so you really can't trust the darkness of the line. You really can't use that as an indicator to whether you have a healthy pregnancy or not.
Right. And I'll second that. And I'll actually go so far to say, so this, there's a very specific term for this in science, because we see this all the time. We talk about qualitative markers versus quantitative markers. Qualitative is always being able to look at images and kind of say a yes, no, it's there, it's not. Usually we use them for things like if we're interested if something is present or something is not. You cannot argue based on darkness, though, like if things are darker or not, and I've seen people try to do this, that that's actually what's going on. Quantitative, so an N instead of an L, is where you get the numbers. And the numbers are what you need. So I will second what Mo is saying, even though I did this to her, where I sent her one where I didn't show up so fast. But the second one I sent you, I got to tell you, the reason I sent you the second one was it came up before the standard.
Yeah,
it was more of a surprise. It was like, wow, that was fast. But as far as being able to sit down and say, wow, it looks like everything is going to be fine, there's no way I could have done that.
No, there's absolutely no way. You could get a really dark line one day that shows up really fast, and the next day get a lighter line, and it's just because you had one extra glass of water, or you did it 5 minutes earlier, or that particular day at the factory, somebody sneezed. I mean, there's so many different things. The only way to see the first indication of healthy pregnancy or unhealthy pregnancy is your beta.
Right. And I'll also go so far to say that with the betas, the medical protocols that are established to be able to take these measurements are so ironclad that if they screw up, they're screwing up with the idea that they could be sued and people are losing their jobs. The pee stick company, if you are trying to figure out if your beta is getting darker, is getting higher or not, no, there's nobody's ass on the line, in all honesty. Other than the fact that, you know, if you have a bunch of them not working, okay, maybe they would pull them back in. But it's not, they're not going to be able to tell you progression. It's all a matter of, yes, you are at this point in time. We know that basically is we know that you have HCG in your body.
Right.
So.
Right. So if you're trying on your own at this point, if you're just charting and temping and you get a positive pregnancy test, really the next indication that you're going to want to do is you're going to want to go in and get a blood test. Now, here's the trick, ladies. If let's say you are like me and you happen to have early implanters, which has really always been the case with me, I've always, always gotten in all 5 pregnancies, I have gotten positive pee sticks at 8 DPO. Especially if that's the case, you're still going to want to wait until the day that your period is due at least to get your beta. So let's talk about this. So first of all, let's talk about the other situation, which is when to know if it's a done deal or not, whether this month is officially over, okay? And that's happened to me a bunch of times too. But I unfortunately have the history of 5 pregnancies to let me know that, you know I have early implanters. So I usually had the situation where if I got a negative pregnancy test at 10 days past ovulation, I knew I was out for the month. But this is after months and months and months and 5 pregnancies worth of experience. So that's me. But for most people, chances are you're kind of lost if you're at 12 DPO using, let's say, a first response early result or a baby confirm, which is a less well-known high sensitivity test, which I'm a big fan of. If you're at 12 or 13 DPO with those and you're still getting negatives, chances are you're out for the month. But on the other hand, my big saying is always
it's not over till the red lady sings. So mm-hmm. if you haven't gotten your period yet, you're still in it. But the second you get your period, obviously you're out. Now, there's another thing, which is that this has actually happened to me, and I have to talk about this because there's the issue of an unhealthy pregnancy. Right. I actually had gotten my period and been pregnant once. So my whole saying of it's not over till the red lady sings is a fallacy for myself. And the reason that happened was actually I was having an ectopic pregnancy, and what I thought was my period was actually very heavy implantation bleeding that was happening because it was implanting in a damaged tube. So I had 3 days of bleeding of an ectopic pregnancy, which I thought was just a really strange period. But that's really rare. That like hardly ever happens. The way you can tell that it's not that, like the way you can tell that it's not an actual period is if it's just really different kind of bleeding and it happens a little too early. Then you know that then you can suspect something is wrong and maybe go to a doctor. But that's, you know, a completely different story for most people, because like I said, I'm a statistical anomaly and I'm a freak show. For most people, period shows up, you're not pregnant, you know, let's get this next month started.
Right. But the thing that we're now getting into, I think, is worthwhile talking about is also what happens if you get that positive pregnancy and then the lines do start to go. Like, what happens if you wake up one day, you have it, you wake up the next day, and then you don't?
This is where things get a little dicey. This is where we start getting into chemical pregnancies and problematic implantation and a lot of just unpleasantness that happens in terms of early loss. So this is why, this brings me back to why I said don't get that beta until at least the day that your period is due, if not a day or two afterwards. Because really, it does happen that you have implantation and then immediately the pregnancy becomes not viable. It actually becomes a chemical pregnancy. You get your period maybe a day late or right on time. This does happen. And it's a loss like any other loss. If you're a P-stick person, you're gonna, you know, this is the downside of being a P-stick person. It's, maybe more information than you want sometimes. Chemical pregnancies happen because the fertilized egg is not healthy. Usually, 9 times out of 10, sometimes it's implantation issues. It's a whole different kind of other infertility. If you're having a lot of these, if say, you know, for several months you find yourself getting early positive P sticks and then getting your period a day late or on the day of, then that means you have a problem and you need to get yourself to a doctor. There's actually a blogger who know, like, finally, she's finally about to hit her second trimester. And I think this is going to be, I mean, she's in the double digits in terms of pregnancies, just the sheer staggering amount of chemical pregnancies that this woman has had, is insane. So chemical pregnancies are an issue, and actually it's a diagnostic tool in that case, a P-stick. If you're getting early positive pregnancy tests and then they become negative, get thee to a doctor. But yes, that is a chemical pregnancy, but that is also why you really, unless this is happening a lot, which, you know, again, is a rare condition, but it happens, you really don't want to get to a blood test until you're on the day your period is due or the day after. And the reason is that that first beta number is an important number. And if you go in too early, you might get unnecessarily worried. And there is such a thing as too much information.
Mm-hmm.
If you go in and get your beta taken a day after your positive first response early result test, chances are your beta is going to be under 30. And the doctor is going to look at it and is going to worry you with his or her reaction. Because, you know, a beta under 30, we've said it's not good. The reason you want to do it on the day your period is due is because by then, It's a good indication. It's the day that, you know, doctor knows how to look at this number and kind of judge it properly. If your beta is too low, because you got your beta early, really all it does is give you a couple more days to stress out and wait and see whether it doubles properly when you go and get another one. So again, this is my personal thing. I know that once you get that pee stick, especially women who've had repeat losses, you really want to see that beta number. You really want to get right. this pregnancy confirmed.
Right, and I'll actually go so far to also point out the fact that there are some clinics where if their patients come back with a beta over 100, they will not require a second beta, though I always think a second beta is good just to see what's going on. But what I have found in the past is that if the number is below 100, you will be doing more than two betas. I would absolutely agree with Mo. If it's a matter of being stuck multiple times and freaking out for close to a week, which is not fun, versus waiting a few days and then going in and just having two blood draws, wait. Don't put yourself through that stress. So
yeah, because no matter what, your betas are going to be low the first couple days after implantation, and they really are looking for a number. On the day your period is due, they really are looking for a number that's over 100. And you know, it becomes like a whole dramatic thing. Like for me, again, this time around, I had my first beta drawn at 12 DPO and it was 75. And my clinic, my RE, was wary about it, even though they knew very well I was a 12 DPO. They were still wary about that 75, and it was a mistake. I should have waited two more days. I went in and I got the blood draw early, and I should have waited two more days. The only reason there was no freak out is because the second beta, which happened 2 days later, was more than triple, and it was mm-hmm. already in the 300s. So nobody was worried at that point because they saw it was you know, multiplying nicely. But it was a mistake. It was a mistake because I basically spent a weekend being unsure, and it gave me nothing. That early beta draw gave me absolutely nothing. So, ladies, day your period is due or the day after is really when you want to get that first beta. And if you're at an RE, or if you're at least some sort of being monitored by your regular gyno at this point, they're going to agree with us on this. So just do that. So, okay. So now we've gotten through like the pregnancy test crazies. I personally, and this is a psychological thing, we can discuss this. The reason I'm a huge pee stick aficionado is because I'm an impatient person and I like to know if I'm out of the game, I'd want to know earlier rather than later. And what the pee sticks did for me on negative cycles, which obviously I've had more negative cycles than positive cycles, despite my 5 positive cycles. What they did for me on negative cycles was they actually made the transition into my period a lot easier. Now, a lot of women who get their period get really depressed. They cry. They are not happy when the red lady shows up. And what the pee sticks did for me was really set the emotional, you know, just kind of pad the emotional ground and made it easier for me to get my period. By the time I got my period, I already knew I was out. And so the PMS wasn't nearly as bad. There was a lot less crying. I'd already made peace with the fact that I was out for that cycle, and I was ready to look ahead to the next one. And especially for women with bad PMS, it might be a good coping mechanism. You never know. So I know it was for me. It was my way of kind of softening the blow.
But I'll also say, though, that so I was charting and temping, and I guess my indicator was when I was watching the temps start to come down.
Yeah.
So I always knew, like, at least a day or two ahead of time that things were not going to work, and I was not doing HTPs.
HPTs.
Yeah, sorry.
That's the same way.
I used to get so depressed. Looking at a what they call a stark white BFN would make me super depressed. Like, I'd rather just wait and then, you know, have my period show up and watch the temps go down. It felt like more of like a gentle letdown than like, bam, in your face.
On the
not
other
pregnant.
Hand, if you have right. And so I'm with Shelley on this one. So I think what Mo's bringing up is you need to decide who you are and where you're at.
what works best
for and you. What works best for you. Because for me, seeing that negative pregnancy test, I mean, it's hard. It's really, really hard. Well, I realized really quickly that in no way was it helping me. And in fact, it was actually making things a lot worse.
See, for mm-hmm. me, so. I think if you see enough of them, you get desensitized. Potentially.
You know, but I also think it's just a matter of what works out well for you. Because as Shelly's bringing up, like, after a while I'd get my period and I was like, it was fine, you know, it was okay. But even on the cycles where I knew I was gonna get my period, because I knew that there was no way this was gonna happen, and for some reason I would do an HTP just to be extra careful, mm-hmm. I always was in a worse mood after doing it, even if I, you know, if I had not done that, if I had just waited for the period to come, I would have been a lot better.
I totally respect that, but I really do think it's an issue of desensitizing, because you're talking to a woman, I pee starting at 7 DPO. I have seen so many negative pregnancy tests, so many of them, that it is less of an issue for me. Sometimes for me, a negative pregnancy test is like, okay, still early. It's not necessarily... I mean, with this current pregnancy, I had 2 negative pregnancy tests before I had the positive pregnancy test.
So, I know, and Ray almost flew out to Israel and started and trying to hide those from you.
That's true. I agree. I mean, again, this is my personal form of crazy. I guess it's just because once you've been pregnant as often as I have, I guess you just get into your little pattern of crazy. Maybe that's just what it is. I've seen quite a few more positive pregnancy tests than most women. I've also seen, as a result of that, quite a few more negative pregnancy tests than most women. And I have seen every single kind of loss in the book, more or less. So, you know, it's a triple-edged sword.
Right. But what I think we should move on to now is, so we talked briefly about chemicals.
Yeah.
I want to talk about ectopics and detecting ectopics.
Yes.
Especially at this stage, because I think it's really important to know, like, what the signs are for a lot of women, because a lot of women don't know. A lot of women don't know what an ectopic is, and then also being able to detect it is another thing that would be worthwhile.
I thought I was a miscarriage pro before my ectopic. I was wrong. You really don't know unless you know. So yeah, that's a really good point. We should definitely talk about it. So ectopics, here's the tricky thing about ectopic pregnancies is that they're not always the same from pregnancy to pregnancy. They manifest themselves in a few different ways. But no matter what, if they go long enough undetected, they can be incredibly dangerous. Mm-hmm. You can lose a tube. They can...
at the minimum, you could lose a tube, but the maximum, there are women who have died.
Yes.
So
yes.
Let's be honest. This can kill you if you don't deal with it.
Yes. But again, we don't want to cause unnecessary panic because here's the sucky part. A lot of early pregnancy symptoms mimic some ectopic pregnancy symptoms. And mm-hmm. and this is the thing, and people and women freak out. Women who've had repeat losses or women who've been in this community long enough to know that this is possible, in early pregnancy, they can very easily start imagining they're having ectopic pregnancies when they're really not. It's a really easy kind of fear to go to. So let's start with this. The chances of the way to get ectopic pregnancies to become life-threatening is when the fetus is large enough so that your tube bursts and causes internal bleeding. Now, that is not going to happen in the first 4-5, or like when you're 4 or 5 weeks pregnant. That can only potentially happen when you're 6 weeks pregnant, 7 weeks pregnant. So you really don't want to freak out about having internal bleeding and dying when you're 4 weeks pregnant. You've got enough things to worry about, okay? So let's just start with that. But here's really the first indication of an ectopic pregnancy is an unhealthy doubling, as in your beta is not doubling properly.
Mm-hmm. But so beta starts out low and it's not going up.
Yeah. Now, but again, this is not necessarily the case with all ectopics. Some ectopics have properly doubling betas or pretty close to properly doubling betas. But a lot of it, the first indication is a low beta that isn't doubled properly. So what happens basically at that point, if you are under observation, is they probably wait and wait until they can see some sort of indication of finding the pregnancy. So you can't actually see a pregnancy on an ultrasound until the beta. I think that the marker is 1,000, right, Christine?
No, higher than that, actually. Right. They want you, I was told that you need to be around anywhere from 10 to 15,000 for them to be able to actually see a sac.
Because yes. I've heard that it can be low as 1,000.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. I was told that they need it up. So I think the thing to do, and this is what's very important, is as soon as you have that positive HTP, call your doctor, go in for a blood draw.
Yes. No. As soon as your period is due, if you've had a positive HPT, let's level this out. Call your doctor, go in for a blood draw. If you're doing it too early, then you're going to get a low number and you're going to freak out unnecessarily. So let's make this clear. The day your period is due, you're going in, you're getting a blood draw. That's number one.
Right.
48 hours later, you go in, you see if that number is doubled, right?
Right.
That's number two. Assuming that number hasn't doubled, what they're going to want to do is they're going to want to monitor you, which means going in every 48 hours for another blood draw.
Which we fondly term as the beta roller coaster, which I have done. And let me tell you, it's fun. But yes, every 48 hours you will go in and they will stick you. Yeah. And they will continue to stick you and just to see if the level is rising and if it continues to rise. So again, for ladies, if you go in early, you could be looking. I think I had a total of 7 blood draws.
Yeah, I had something close to that with my second miscarriage. It was not fun.
Mm-hmm.
Not fun at all. So you're really so basically you go on a beta roller coaster and then one of a few things happen. One, they decide before they see a sac, they decide that the pregnancy is suspected ectopic. It's definitely not viable. And then you're given a couple of options, wait it out or get a methotrexate shot. Which basically kills the multiplying cells in your body, you wait it out. And some women choose to wait it out, and that's completely respectable. However, that's when it becomes a little dicey. And, you know, most women, not every woman who listens to this podcast and not every woman who charts and temps is under supervision of a doctor, might not be able to get a beta draw as soon as, you know, the day her period is due. Have things work a little differently. The other thing is if you haven't had betas drawn but you know you're pregnant, is if you've got stabbing pains in one side or another of your body.
Mm-hmm.
Stabbing pains, dizziness, lightheadedness, unexplained bleeding, any of that. And we're not talking like slight little stabby pains that you could get in early. We're talking like, I've had it. We're talking knives being stuck in your stomach, ladies. Like, literally, somebody is stabbing you. That's when you need to get to a hospital. That's when you are in danger. Of either losing a tube or losing your life. God, spaghetti monster forbid. But that's basically the ectopic situation.
Well, there's one other sign, which is that, and again, this one is... It needs to be observed in combination, but bleeding. So if you are, and I'm not talking spotting where you have a little brown spotting, I'm talking bleeding, like where you are getting more and more blood that's coming out. But the thing is that it is common to bleed during early pregnancy too. So hence the reason why that beta is important. The beta will give a few different things as far as a biomarker. The level will tell them where you're kind of at. Is it progressing well? Is it not? It will also give them an idea as far as where it may be located. Because if things are not progressing, if it starts low and it doesn't really progress, then usually they start to suspect ectopics. But also if you're having bleeding, let your practitioner know too.
Yeah. Yep. Very true. Again, bleeding is something that needs to be addressed regardless. It happens in 1/3 of healthy pregnancies. It does.
Mm-hmm.
But it also happens with each and every single miscarriage. It's like my mantra whenever I get paranoid about miscarrying is I'm not cramping and bleeding, so far so good.
And really, it's an indication of things possibly going wrong. So always get it addressed. But chances are you still one in three healthy pregnancies do have bleeding, and chances are if it's just brown spotting, you're fine. So it really does change from pregnancy to pregnancy. And the point is, what you really want to do, and we've talked about miscarriage here before, so we really don't need to go, into the ins and outs of that whole thing. But really what you want to do is just make sure you get your ass monitored as much as you possibly can, and insist on it. Better safe than sorry. You're better off, and we say this here all the time, you're better off being classified as a difficult patient than not getting your needs met. And that's really what it is. You be a difficult patient if that's what's going to keep you sane. Because the only person who feels your loss is you and your, and hopefully your partner, not that we want your partners to suffer, but it's you and your partner. But the only person who actually feels it physically, who has to go through it physically, is you. And you know, you don't want to be a year down the line, a month down the line, saying, oh, if only I had asked for X, if only I had insisted on Y. Okay, let's really talk about what happens when you've been temping and charting for, say, 6 months, and you've been timing your intercourse perfectly, and there's still no pregnancy. What do you do next? Now, a lot of people, you know, not everybody can get into CNRU right away. Not everybody can afford to see an RU right away. A lot of women will go and get care from their gynecologist, from their primary gyno, at least at first, when it comes to infertility. And most women will at least get their initial blood work done by their primary gynecologist. So basically, you walk into your gyno's office and you say, hey, you know, I've been charting, I've been temping, I've been using OPKs, whatever, I've been doing timed intercourse, and I'm not knocked up, and it's been 6 months. What'll happen then is the gynecologist will give you basically a series of blood tests just to check what's going on. So, Christy, why don't you give, because you know this stuff, I'm sure, in and out. So why don't we go over that?
Yeah. So there's, I'll be honest. I was not seeing my gyno at the time. I was actually already seeing an RE, when all this workup was done. But the disclosure is also, I was a graduate student where the medical facility I was seeing was not equipped to be really dealing with women who were trying to get pregnant. Most of the things that they were dealing with, since it was a university campus, was preventing pregnancy and just doing standard care. So, yeah. Usually with the workups, there's a few things to think about. So one of the things you want to think about is that your cycle is basically split into two phases. So you have the initial phase, which is the part where you're going to be growing an egg and also building your lining. And then there's the second phase where, and this is post-ovulation, where the egg, if egg and sperm meet, then basically that will embed into the uterine lining. So they are going to actually be measuring hormone levels at those two different phases. So the first thing they're going to be looking at is a hormone called FSH, or known as follicle-stimulating hormone. Mm-hmm. Another thing they're going to be looking at along the lines is also at your estrogen levels. Your thyroid is a major regulator for most of the hormones in your body, if not all of them. You should get your thyroid check. I can't tell you the number of women that have had trouble conceiving and then have gone in and addressed their thyroid issues and have no trouble conceiving after that. So getting your thyroid check is huge. And also there are antibodies that you can get checked for that are against your thyroid. So if they do that test, I would ask about it. So thyroid, they're looking at TSH and then something called, and there's two different types. They call it T3 and T4. And then also you should check to see if they check for antibodies. So that all occurs around like 3 days after the first day of your menstrual cycle.
Right. So you've got what's called CD3 blood work, that checks all of this stuff. Now, for a lot of women, and especially those with, you know, some women will get back that blood work, and the problem will be obvious right away. They'll have a thyroid issue. They'll have some sort of hormonal imbalance. This, by the way, happens with some women with polycystic ovarian syndrome. They've got, you know, too much testosterone, a bunch of different other issues, and then they, you know, automatically get that PCOS diagnosis. And then, you know, they can proceed accordingly. Most women who have get a PCOS diagnosis, some of them won't even go to an RE. Some of them will stay, if their gynecologist is confident enough with Clomid, for instance, some women will just get Clomid and just do a couple of Clomid cycles and get pregnant. That happens with a lot of PCOS women. So there are gynecologists who are comfortable enough doing that. But anyway, most women, unfortunately, will not get any clear-cut answers.
Right.
That's from true. From that blood work. But what that blood work is really meant to do is to rule out clear-cut answers.
Right. Well, and that initial. So the second half of your cycle is when the big hormone you're looking at is for progesterone. And this was actually my issue. So the big thing, ladies, the big thing is that you want that blood draw done 7 days past ovulation, not day, so most of physicians will sit down and say you're on a 28-day cycle, even though you could be on a 32-day cycle or something along those lines. So you really do need to know when you're ovulating. Because if you don't, if you get that blood drawn too early or too late, it's not an accurate measurement of your progesterone. So you need to have it done 7 days past ovulation. You need to have your blood needs to be drawn, and they're going to check your progesterone levels at that point too.
And what exactly does it mean if your progesterone level is too low?
So if it's too low, it means that a couple of things. One is that you are probably going to have a shorter luteal phase. So you'll probably be able to detect it because you'll notice that if you're charting over time, that instead of bleeding 14 days, 12 to 14 days deep, past ovulation, you're bleeding earlier than that, maybe like 10. So if your period's starting earlier, it suggests that you are not maintaining the lining. But the other thing is that this is controversial. There is this belief that progesterone does nothing. And yet for recurrent miscarriage, one of the first things they do is they supplement women for progesterone. So we're starting to learn a bit more about the value of progesterone. And honestly, I think that's a big problem for me. I think that the reason why I was losing pregnancies is that my progesterone levels were just not high enough. And that progesterone is actually around to help maintain the growing fetus until the placenta takes over. So there's a reason why you'll hear women be on PIO shots or supplementation until about 10 to 12 weeks of pregnancy. And that's around 10 weeks is when the placenta takes over and maintains everything.
The interesting thing is, and this is really kind of where things get a little freaky. Most doctors will not actually admit to that being the case. I actually have both of my doctors, my RE and my regular gyno, have both said, with regards to my progesterone supplementation, you can do either or. You can either do it or not do it. It's totally your choice. You choose to do it. That's fine. We're going to, you know, give you the prescription, but you don't have to do it. I've actually had both of my doctors say that. Like all research says, and this is, and again, this is, you know, experience versus scientific whatever. Scientific research so far has been inconclusive, but the fact is that I know of one person who, as a result of progesterone supplementation, finally carried to term.
Yep.
A good friend of mine had 4 losses. Couldn't afford an RE. Finally, after loss number 4, went to a repeat loss specialist. All she did, because that's all she could afford, was progesterone supplementation, and she carried to term.
Yep.
So again, this is kind of the science is still iffy on this.
The science is, and it's hard because there, as you're bringing up before, because of the fact the science is iffy, there are some doctors that really don't believe in it. There are, but ironically enough, what you will see consistently is, regardless of what type of IUI or IVF treatment you go through, there's usually progesterone involved. In fact, for all IVF, even though you have corpus lutea, depending upon the number of eggs they get from you, they always supplement with progesterone. And I know for my sister-in-law, that was all it took to, was just supplementing with progesterone and we have my nephew. So it's something to look into. And progesterone comes in many, many forms. So it's a matter of talking with people about what works and what they'll do. Prometrium, which was the first one that I used, was dirt cheap. I think it was like $20 for a bunch of vials worth that easily would have taken me through a pregnancy. $20.
Yep.
So.
Yep. And for most people, that's enough. You know, most people don't need the PIO, the progesterone in oil shots. That's, you know, that's varsity level progesterone supplementation right there. Most women, all they really need is some sort of suppository, basically sticking progesterone up their cooch for the first trimester, and they're fine. Most women with progesterone deficiencies. But again, this is something that really you should be looking into if you've had multiple unexplained loss, even if you've had two, mm-hmm. not three. It's something that worth doing, supplementing with progesterone, because again, it doesn't hurt. And this is the thing that, you know, both of my doctors have said very clearly, is it doesn't hurt.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it might help. It definitely doesn't hurt. So why not do it?
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of the philosophy of most doctors when it comes to progesterone supplementation. And that I think is a healthy philosophy to have. And I think anecdotally we can tell that it does do something.
And but I do think people should be aware that I did a lot of research into the whole progesterone thing, and a lot of doctors have like this weird reaction to it. Like my RE was like, he thought of it as like one of these things that people think is like this magic, you know, ticket. But really his opinion was, if you're not producing enough progesterone, it's because like the miscarriage is supposed to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Basically like you can't save a pregnancy by giving the progesterone. If it's supposed to be a healthy pregnancy, then you will produce enough progesterone on your own. So that's why he doesn't supplement IUI cycles with progesterone. Mm-hmm. And then I had a loss during an IUI cycle, so I don't know. But you could, I don't, maybe it's the older school. Like my guy's kind of old. He was kind of older
school.
It is.
I think it is older school. So I mean, yeah. again, it is worthwhile. It's just be aware that as Shelley's bringing up, you may get some pushback, because I know at least with both my doctors, specifically the one I have now, both of them have been like, oh no, we need to supplement. And in fact, my first doctor was, she specialized in luteal phase defects. And she's like, I truly believe this is a bigger issue than what's out there. The reason the data doesn't exist is because we haven't been doing the experiments correctly, which based on the data I've seen, I would agree with that. But the other thing is that it's, you know, it's just, it, there's a reason why that hormone exists. It's not a vestigial hormone that you don't need. There's a reason why it exists. There's a reason why it goes up. There's a reason why they monitor it. So I agree with what Shelley is bringing up, which is that if you're in the middle of a miscarriage, supplementing with progesterone is not going to save it. But I also don't agree with this philosophy that if you aren't making enough initially, that it just means that you won't carry. Because I have seen what Mo is talking about, which is women who have recurrent miscarriages, that as soon as they get supplemented, then they are fine.
Well, here's the thing, too. The woman I'm specifically talking about, she was very, very nervous about getting supplemented with progesterone. And this is the other issue. Getting supplemented with progesterone does have its drawbacks. Now, you know, it could be, and Shelley's RE would probably argue that the reason this woman's fifth pregnancy held where her four others didn't wasn't because of the progesterone supplementation, but because it was the first healthy pregnancy she had. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what probably Shelley's RE would argue. And that's, you know, that could be a legitimate argument. The drawback of progesterone supplementation, there's a couple of them. One is that it might actually perpetuate an unhealthy pregnancy that would pass on its own.
True.
You know, it will hold up a pregnancy that's not supposed to hang around. It's unhealthy, chromosomal issues, that kind of thing. It will keep up a pregnancy in that case where it shouldn't. And then the other thing, and it's something, again, you have to keep in mind, is that progesterone supplementation has not been going on for that long. And so in terms of its effects on the baby, it's really not known whether it has any adverse effects on the child that's developing. Because again, you're looking at not your natural progesterone, but an artificial supplementation. And so it's unclear, since that is basically what sustains the baby in the first, in the first trimester. It's not, there isn't any clear cut research about whether that has any adverse effects. And I can tell you that my friend who carried to term because of progesterone supplementation, she was really worried about that. Mm-hmm. So again, it's a balance that you eventually have to make the decision about what's good for you. And my friend who's gone through this was obviously very happy that she made her specific decision. So it could be, if you're found to have a progesterone issue early on, that that's all you really need, because it could be that that's what's causing implantation issues or early loss. So we've got the blood work down. I really think that, the important thing is we've got to really address the women who don't go to an RE, who can't afford an RE. Because, once you get into an RE's office, they go into in-depth blood work and they start, giving you treatment, whether it's Clomid or Femara, or they send your husband in for a sperm analysis. They do all this fun stuff, and you're under the care of an RE, and then you're really getting into the varsity stuff.
Right.
The issue is, what happens if you're unsuccessful? You can't afford an RE. What do you do at this point?
So I think the thing also to find out at this point in time, before, when you're starting to deal with this, is, one, what's going on with insurance? What will insurance cover? Will it not? Also looking at what types of plans that are available. It's possible to be able to switch plans, and all of a sudden there are options that are available for you that previously weren't, for a little bit more money a month. So definitely look into that. The other thing to consider along the way is that when you're going in to do all this blood work or to find out what's going on, is to talk to your gyno to see how far they're willing to go. Some gynos, and I know this was the case with mine, were not really willing to do anything because they had no idea. But I know of gynos out there that are willing to do things like prescribe Clomid and watch. And some even go as far as doing IUIs, I think. So it is a matter of talking with your physicians and really talking about what will you do, what will you not do, and also what is covered. And if they're worth their snuff, if they know their trade, they will walk through things with you and they will be honest. So again, this may not be the most comfortable of conversations, but I think it's a good one to have.
Yeah. And I mean, a good enough doctor might refer you to a colleague who's better mm-hmm. equipped to deal with this stuff, might refer you to a regular practicing gynecologist who is still a specialist in a specific field, depending on the blood work. It's not 100% clear cut. You don't always have to put out that, $200, $400 on an RE appointment. However, here's the thing, and this is really the big thing. Even if you're not planning on doing treatments, okay, I do think that if you're at a crossroads where your gynecologist has done all he or she can do for you, it's worth the one-time payment of $200 to $400, if it's not covered in your insurance, to go see an RE once. Because even if you're not covered by your insurance, even if this is, you can't pursue treatment, even if you can't even pursue an IUI, going to an RE once just to get a clear picture will make things a lot easier for you. Because at least that way, let's say you can't afford treatment right now, but let's say you know for a fact that that the RE thinks the best plan of action for you is to go straight into IUI, or to go, or you could do 6 rounds of Clomid and then, see what happens. There's, according to your blood work and your history, an RE will look at you and say, okay, this is the path of treatment I would take. Just because an RE plans out a path of treatment for you doesn't mean you have to walk that path immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something really interesting that Esperanza wrote on her blog. She's suffering from secondary infertility right now. And she and her husband will not be able to afford IVF. And they know this. And they went into an RE's office. And they got kind of an outline of what their possible path is. And then once they did that, they decided that they're going to hold off on doing, you know, they can't afford a couple of IUIs and they're going to probably consider that. But before doing those couple of IUIs, they decided to wait 3 months and try natural remedies. Going to that RE gave them focus.
Keep in mind with a reproductive endocrinologist, so they have gone through medical school just as everybody else that is going to be a physician does. They have gone on to do specialties in obstetrics and gynecology, just like your OB and your OBGYN does. But then they go further. They go further and they do additional training. Usually that training takes anywhere from 2 to 4 years, depending upon what their specialty is. They will also seek out programs that specialize in this, and there's only a few around the country. There are many medical schools in the U.S. and even throughout Europe, as well as around the globe. There's only a few that actually specialize in this stuff, and they will actually go so far to do rotations in clinics that are actively doing fertility treatments. So there's a lot of hands-on. There's a lot more education. There's a lot more time. There's a lot more certification. And every single one of your reproductive endocrinologists will become members of the American Association for Reproductive Medicine. Your gynecologist may not have that membership. Your gynecologist right. certainly has not gone as far as sitting down and really thinking about this stuff. Your gynecologist, more along these lines, is interested in delivering babies. And there's nothing wrong with that. But it is worthwhile to recognize that if you are going to somebody who is used to dealing with women who are simply needing just basic care until they deliver, and then you're asking them about how to conceive, they may not be the best qualified person to actually help you out. Whereas a reproductive endocrinologist, that's what they do.
It's the same. It's like the same exact thing with if you had, you know, a history of high risk pregnancies and late term loss or even first trimester loss, you're not going to stick with a regular gynecologist. You're going to go to a gynecologist who specializes in high risk pregnancy. You just are. You're not going to go into the regular care. And it's the same exact thing goes for an RE. They have hands-on experience that you cannot, you know, that books will not cover. And if you, it could be that an RE will take one look at your medical history and your blood work and know exactly the path of treatment just based on experience. And that's something that a regular gynecologist can't do. So, you know, I think any woman who's gone down this path and has spent, you know, $5 on an iPhone app and, you know, $100 on pee sticks can afford after a few months of scrimping and saving to go to one RE appointment and just get an outline of what the possibilities are. Because really, even if you can't pursue treatment at that exact moment, you know. And either you have something to look ahead to. Like, for instance, I have a friend who knows who had crappy insurance. She had shit insurance. And she went and spent out of pocket to see an RE. And RE told her exactly what her issues were. She saw from the blood work immediately what her issues were. He told her, you're going to need to go immediately to IVF. This is your situation. And my friend spent a year getting retrained and looking for a new job so that she could get new insurance coverage so that she'd be able to get IVF covered. And and so she basically changed her life path. She said, okay, I want IVF. I can't afford it out of pocket. I'm going to, my plan is to get a new job that will give me the health insurance that will cover IVF. And so that's what she did. And that's what she's doing now. And in 2 months from now, her insurance is going to kick in and she's going to get IVF coverage. And so, you know, I personally feel like I can't afford it is really kind of sitting on the fence. And again, not to attack, but, you know, scraping together the $200 to go see an RE is, I think, something most people can do.
And or even just sitting down and assessing your insurance options and saying, if I can't do it right now, when would I be able to do it? So, do I just need a different insurance plan, or, you know, is my spouse changing insurance, or am I changing insurance, or something along those lines. Right. So it is a matter of, unfortunately, people, this is where you got to start thinking creatively. Mm-hmm. On my end, I went to the university.
Yep.
And saw an RE because it was cheaper. It was substantially cheaper to be able to do that at that initial workup and other things like that. And it worked out for me. It got us the tools we needed to be able to at least sit down and begin the process.
Right.
So,
and we're going
to
talk.
It's something to consider.
Yeah, I mean, we're gonna do a whole show that's going to be dedicated to funding this stuff. But really, you got to start somewhere, ladies. And I think this is what we're, if you're going to get anything from the show, because we're running long as usual, so we should probably wrap things up. If you're going to get anything from this episode, that's really what you should get, is you got to start somewhere. So you know you have a problem, go see a specialist. Even if you can't afford the solution right now, at least you know what the solution is. You have a place to start. And then you can choose to go wherever you're going to go from there. And really, that's if there's any bit of wisdom that you ladies take away from this, except, of course, that you can get, you know, you can pee on stuff really early, you know, then this is it. Okay, but I think we should wrap it up because this is getting long. And is there anything else we want to cover that we haven't covered,
ladies? No.
You're good? Okay, good. Just for the record, because we do need to stop, but I have yet to rant about the Kimye. I feel like I haven't properly ranted about Kimye, and I haven't properly ranted about Jessica Simpson. So can I just say, and this is terrible, but I don't know if you guys, I heard a rumor that Khloe Kardashian's pregnant too.
Oh, good. No way.
Yeah, I heard a rumor that Khloe Kardashian's pregnant, and to make matters worse, she and Kim have signed on for a pregnant sisters reality show for E! For
this thing. Oh. So, I just saw a headline, Khloe Kardashian is not pregnant or planning new reality show with sister Kim Kardashian.
Oh, seriously? Oh, thank goodness. When did you see this? Because this was driving me nuts.
I just Googled it, and it was 2 days ago from the New York Daily News.
So. Oh, but if you do want to rant, if you do.
Rant,
right. Yeah, rant. Have you heard that Angelina Jolie may be pregnant with seventh child?
Okay.
No way.
I actually did hear about this.
And wait, where do you guys get your celeb information?
I was at the grocery store, and I walked up, and Star Magazine was right there, and I'm like, oh, my God.
And I admit to going to TMZ every once in a while and HuffPost celebrity also. I admit to doing that. But really, I am just so relieved right now that Khloe Kardashian's not pregnant. I know she's infertile and you know our hearts go out to her and everything, but just the thought of a Prego Kardashian reality show made me so sick to my stomach. I'm so happy that that's not true. Oh my gosh, you have no idea. Okay, so anyway. And you know what? I'm okay with Angelina because they're, you know, they've been open. They've done the IVF and haven't lied about it. So, you know, and yes, they name their children weird names, but not nearly as weird as some other people.
Yeah.
So, I like the weird names. Wait, but were they open about doing IVF?
Yeah. Yes, they were. With her twins. She has said that her twins, Knox and Vivian, are products of IVF, not because they had fertility problems, but because of the fact that they couldn't seem to be in the same place at the same time. Mm. So they just decided to go that route. So,
mean, either that's true or not. It could just be that they don't know, they you know, couldn't time intercourse long enough to know that, you know, if they could do it or
that's
not.
True.
Who knows?
Right.
I mean, that makes sense. And you know, I don't hate her for it, so it's okay. Like, I was, okay, anecdote before we wrap up. I was talking to my best friend the other day, and we were talking about the fact that I, being a huge American Idol fan, I have not watched American Idol this season. And she was very much in shock because I'm a huge Idol fan. I've seen every single season since the first episode of the first season. And I've not watched a season. And she's wondering why. And I'm like, I despise Mariah Carey. I hate her guts. There are very few celebrities, with the exception of Kim Kardashian, who I hate as much as I hate Mariah Carey. And she's like, why do you hate Mariah Carey so much? And I said, well, one thing is that she did IVF and she will never admit that she did IVF. And the second thing is that she named her son Moroccan. And
And, you know, my best friend's like, well, listen, not everybody's going to be open about their medical treatments. And, you know, you can't hold it against her. And, you know, she made some very interesting points that were like, okay, with Mariah Carey not revealing the inner workings of her ute. Fine. And I'm like, you know what? That's fine. But she still named her son Moroccan. That is an unforgivable sin.
We need to finish today, and we can pick up later, but I actually have the opposite issue. And I mean, my issue is the fact that she's been so adamant about it and against it, and then has actually said that the reason she was able to get pregnant is that she just did acupuncture at age 41. So Hollywood, all that wonderful stuff. Don't want
to
go there.
We need to talk about celebrity names, though. Listeners, okay, so we're going to give out our contact info. Here's what we want this week. If there are celebrity baby names that particularly annoy you, email us. Let's talk about this next week. We need to talk about really terrible celebrity baby names.
Because let's talk about it, because I'm one of those people who I love the crazy names, so that'll be a good conversation.
Yeah, because, I mean, seriously, I think it makes perfect sense to hate a woman simply based on the fact that she named her child Moroccan. This is all I'm saying. It makes perfect sense. So,
wow.
I mean, I could live with Shiloh and Suri and Apple. Moroccan? No. Just no. Anyway, okay. But enough for this week. Email us, bitterandfertiles@gmail.com. Go to our website, bitterandfertiles.wordpress.com. Follow us on Twitter, @bitterandfertile, without the S. And leave us hate comments, because you'll get featured prominently at the top of our show. So why the hell not, right, ladies?
Yes.
Yeah, so thank you for joining us, and we will see you next week.
Bye, everybody.
Bye, guys.